I don't think that, I mean, from what I've read from Christian and even non-Christian sources, it's not really that Galileo, he did come up, certainly, he was able to show that, yes, it's not, it's a heliocentric, the sun is the center of the universe, the earth rotates around it. I don't really, from what my reading of history, I don't see that the church was trying to suppress Galileo, but from what I understand what was going on there, and this is by a woman by the name of Kirsten Burkett, she wrote a comprehensive article on this. She's a teacher somewhere in the United Kingdom. I don't know which school. But she was saying, now, was the Roman Catholic Church sort of like caught off guard by what Galileo was saying? The point that she was making was that, yes, there were people in the Roman Catholic Church that were kind of startled by what Galileo was saying, but so were other scientists at the time, because what he was saying was new. And so people need to say, well, we need to actually verify this and see what you're saying is right. So I don't, my reading of history is not that, I don't see that the church was purposely trying to suppress the information from getting out. You may have read other sources, but all that to say, all these things going on, Isaac Newton, you know, gravity, how gravity kept the planets in orbit. The bottom line is this. This was all new and exciting things going on. And people began to say, well, the Earth, is it? Is the world just like a deistic view of the world? Where God created everything, but now it just sort of runs on its own. You know, and God doesn't intervene at all. Is that what's going on? I'm not saying we believe that, but I'm saying that's what people were thinking at the time. And so if it's true that the earth is a closed system, that would mean that the supernatural is not possible. If the supernatural, this follows from this, if the supernatural is not possible, miracles aren't possible. So everything that we read about in the Bible, Jesus supposedly performing these miracles, is just not true. And of course, if that's not true, then there's no God. If there's no God, we don't face judgment. I mean, this sort of all kept, and so this is where you might think it. When I tell you what this philosopher said, you might say, "Ooh, I think that might be a good point." A philosopher like David Hume, who was not a Christian, he's writing things at this time, and so he said, "Well, supernatural is not possible, miracles aren't possible, but in the Bible, we read stories of people saying that Jesus performed miracles." And so Hume raised a really good question: what's more likely? That a miracle would happen, or that a man would tell a lie? I mean, that was his question. What's more likely? That a miracle would take place, or that someone would tell a lie? We don't see people getting up from the dead, do we? So why would we believe that Jesus got up from the dead? Do you see how this is how it follows? So what do we say to that? Well, that was David Hume. That was his question. So then you have a bunch of philosophers at this time who are asking, this to me, you know, is helpful. Just to show this, I'm going to say this. I'm going to say a few more things about some philosophers. Let me just see where we're at. And then we'll say, what does this mean for us today? That's what we're going to do. Okay? We've got 30 minutes left. So I'm just going to put three names, because a lot of these, the reason I'm stating philosophers is because these are the people who influence society. And whether we believe it or not, these men like Hume, writing in the 1700s, is still very popular. And people are still reading him. That's what I mean. You can look at that. What's more likely? You'll hear that. What's more likely? That a miracle would happen if someone would tell a lie. So I've talked about Descartes, but I'm just going to throw him up there one more time. I'm going to mention three philosophers, and this is going to get, we're going to see how this affects the Bible and theology right now. Or if you want to know why we have universalist Unitarians down the street, we're going to get to that right now. Okay? So Descartes, I'm just going to go with the last name. I'll write his first name. René Descartes, Immanuel Kant, you may know that name, a German philosopher. Whenever I think of this Kant, and then now this last name is hard. I'm gonna have to check here. Friedrich Schleiermacher. Whenever I think of these names, we had my professor in Bible college when he introduced us to all of these people. It took a week long. We did a week long survey of it, and he referred to this as Dead German Week. He He said, we're going to...
Right?
Say it again?
Descartes was French, right?
Yeah, yeah. He's not included in that.
Yeah.
Just the last two. Okay. Why are these people significant? Remember what Descartes... I'm just going to put these in line here. Why are these people so influential? Remember what Descartes said. Remember we talked about this last week where he said...
I'll start for myself, basically.
Say it again?
I think
Yes, I think therefore I am. Sorry. Okay. But what he said was, and that meaning, I think therefore I am meaning, remember, how do I doubt everything, and I start by looking inward. That's how I come to truth. I look inside myself, okay? That's how I start, I begin with the self. Kant is influential because Kant, this, I guess I'll write this down. Don't worry about remembering these words, but just remember what I'm going to say about the words. Because Kant said, he thought of knowledge in terms of two realms. And he called it the phenomenal realm. You may remember this. Phenomenal. Am I spelling that right? Phenomenal. One of my biggest sins is misspelling words.
That's good,
though. Yeah.
That's just a joke.
That's just a joke. But he said that he can find knowledge. He said there's the phenomenal realm. That's this earth. And what he called the noumenal realm, which he means is like up there, like metaphysics, what's beyond the physical. Now, here's why this is influential. Kant said, we have no access to this. I can never know this. All I can know, all we can know as human beings is in the material realm. So think about that for just an example. So here's what this means. Now, you can study philosophers, and here's what they're going to say. What Kant said is knowledge does not exist outside the mind. All I can know is what's inside in my mind. I can't know anything outside of it. So first of all, I begin with myself, Descartes, right? I begin with myself. And I can't know anything else beyond this earth. My knowledge is limited to the physical realm. Okay. So I can't know it. My knowledge is confined to this world. Then you get Schleiermacher, who comes along and says, yeah, but religion is a good thing. And Schleiermacher defined religion as the feeling of absolute dependence. So knowledge, so what did he say? If you want to put it in a sentence, Schleiermacher said, religion is feeling. So I can't know anything. So I have to begin with myself. I can't know anything beyond the physical realm. But it's about what I feel on the inside. So where does that leave us?
All me.
Yeah. And so this is why you have, you may have heard this very famous book. I haven't read it. Who wrote it? I don't remember his name. But it's called The Triumph of the Therapeutic. Religion is therapy. You believe what you believe, I believe, I believe. And don't we say this? I don't care if you're a Christian, you can have your own belief. If it helps you, then keep doing it. Right? I mean that's what we say, right? Or that's what we say, but that's what we hear people say. Okay, so one other thing. Then you have people coming, you know, we're coming to the new world in America, and we begin to talk to other people in this world. I'm going somewhere with this. We come in contact with other people who believe differently from us, right? So we live in a pluralistic world, right? Where there's multiple beliefs. You know this, and we're going to talk about this in just a moment, about how it affects us. But we live in a world where there are multiple beliefs, right? Well, but you really believe in all your heart that you're right. Right? If you talk to a Muslim, a serious, devout Muslim, they believe with all their heart that they're right. You talk to a Mormon, they believe with all their heart they're right. Talk to conservative Jews, they believe with all their heart they're right. So we live in a pluralistic world. So then, this is my interpretation now. This is what I think has happened. Pluralism is what has led to relativism. Mm-hmm. Right? Because we all believe we're right. Mm-hmm. So therefore, who's to say? How do we even know?
Oh, look, postmodernism has just arrived.
Yes, we're going to get there. But, okay. So any thoughts or any comments on this? Hey, does this at least help you see how we've got here?
So yeah. I thought that Kant, when he talked about phenomenal versus noumenal, he also went and argued that because we do have noumenal knowledge, it's sort of a counter, like, you set up a counterexample and then prove that the axioms you started out with are inconsistent and must be false. So I thought he also kind of went back and sort of tried to refute Descartes by arguing.
Is that the thesis, antithesis, synthesis? Is that what you're referring to?
I'm more doing just like you set up a logical proof and you get to a contradiction and then you can go back and conclude that the things you set up, the conditions can't all be true. There must be a false thing in there.
Okay. I don't know. Then I don't know that. Okay. You might have to check that on your own. I'm not sure. I haven't heard that. I was going to say the thesis, antithesis, synthesis. I forget. I think that may have been Hume who came up with that. But I could be wrong.
Hegel.
There it is. Thank you. Thank you for that. Good old Hegelians. Okay. What I wanted to do here is just say one other thing. So, and then we're going to move on if we have time. Because any other thoughts, though? Any other thoughts or comments on... We're just sort of seeing how we got here. We can see there's been a long progression. And so any other thoughts or comments? Okay. Now what I'm going to tell you here, this is Charles Taylor's analysis, that philosopher who wrote the book, A Secular Mind. I think this is helpful for us. This gets into some of what, okay, so how do we minister in this kind of culture? What happened? And why, okay, anyways, what Taylor has this great, he says, given the context of the world in which we live in now, and we see the pluralism, which has led to relativism. Now, whether we want to believe this or not, all of that has affected us in some way. Okay, let's just... So what has happened here? And then we're going to come back to that thought. What Taylor says is what all this means for us is that when what we need to know, in particular, he's not talking to Christians, but as Christians, we can apply this. He says we need to know, as we live and minister, that he calls it the location of meaning. So this is just helpful for us to know as we're talking to people.
No.
The location of meaning has shifted. And what he means by that is, so we just need to know this as we're living in this world, that again, in the pre-modern period, people found meaning in their lives, and they found that meaning external from themselves. In other words, they found their meaning outside of themselves. They found their meaning in God, ultimately. They believed in Him. That's how they found meaning in life. Or you could say in the work, their place in society. Now, granted, they didn't live in the kind of way that we live of saying, gosh, what am I going to be when I grow up? It's more like, whatever your dad was is what you're going to be. I mean, it was sort of in the family life. So they didn't even struggle with a lot of that we struggle with, of how do I find meaning. I remember I was reading this book by Ben Sasse. We talked about this, the Sheltons. And he's talking about he was talking to his grandmother one time. And his grandfather was a farmer. He was a farmer because his dad was a farmer, and his dad was a farmer, and his dad was a farmer. And he said he was one time talking to his grandmother, and he said, he's talking to his grandmother, the grandfather was outside working, and he said, Grandma, did Grandpa even really want to be a farmer? Like, is that what he really truly wanted to do in his life? And she was frustrated. She's like, I don't know. He just was a farmer because that's what he was supposed to do, you know? And it was just a different way of looking at things, right? Where, so in this secular age, in the world in which we live and minister, people no longer find their meaning externally. So we just need to know, as we're living and talking with people, this is why, in some ways, I think I need to change what I say in my sermons. Because I appeal to that a lot, that sort of emptiness, that meaning that we feel. But there's a lot of people that don't feel that. You know, when we talk about the God-shaped hole inside their lives that we all have, a lot of times I would imagine if you talk to some people here in New England, they would be like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I'm perfectly fine. I'm perfectly fulfilled. But how do they find that meaning? Yeah.
So most of those people, I won't say all, although I think it's all.
Mm-hmm. I do.
They're living in denial.
Yes.
It's not that that hole isn't there and they don't feel it and they're perfectly content. Mm-hmm. They've been taught that it's a good thing to be perfectly content. Mm-hmm. So in the midst of their discontentment, on the way to the therapist, they complain they're content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's true. Go ahead, Zahar.
I just thought, I can't help but I compare a lot of things, especially in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're talking about is totally perfect, but at the same time, we got to understand that not the entire world thinks like that.
That's true.
And
yes.
I got to tell you this, and I'm not trying to demean any culture or.
No. Please do.
Ideas or this is better than this. But I grew up in a culture where.
Yeah.
Until I arrived in America, I have not heard anyone from my own culture people saying, I got to discover myself, or I got to study all these religions and find out myself in life. We don't have that. You know, there, it's like, you know what you have to do. You go, you study, you graduate, you get a job, you get a life, you get married, and you die. Right? I mean, that's how it is. That's how we're, and you go to the East. Right? Mm-hmm. Go to the East, not only to the Middle East, but go to the East. You'll find the same thing. You know,
right.
People are trying to compete in this life, and this is the one way
you're
going to draw it yourself. But when you come to the Western culture in general, that's when a lot of this starts to actually play out. And
no, I think we're thankful to have someone like you in here who can tell us this, because you're absolutely right.
And again, I'm not saying this is better than this, but I'm just saying this is my experience.
Yeah. But no, it's helpful.
That's a symptom of our excess.
That's how
the sheer excess we have in the West. That we're able to spend so much darn time thinking about ourselves.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of things. It's like getting ourselves food and clothing.
Absolutely. Because when you wake up and take a warm shower that you don't even take for granted, well, when I grow up there, it's like, water, what's that mean? You know, like,
an odd problem to have that we don't turn to God because we're too blessed.
That's very helpful. This one of the things, this is where Tim Keller, his reading has been helpful for me as somebody who's ministered in New York, because he runs into that. I'm just going to say this and then we'll move on, but we need to know this and feel this, because one of the things that people would tell him in New York is the whole, like, he said he found it interesting when he would compare what people in New York say with what people in the East say, because one of the biggest things that people would tell him, well, I cannot believe in a God who would judge others. And he said, it's fascinating that, he said, in the Western context, you can tell me if he's right, but he said, people love the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, love your enemies and forgive them. Like, we just fawn and faint over that. We think it's amazing. He would say, love your enemies. But when he ministered to people in the Eastern culture, that's what they struggle with.
So you said...
That's what they struggle with. Yeah, go ahead.
In pre-modern, people looked at external to self.
Correct.
And you say now people no longer find their meaning
externally. Yes. And to go basically what Zahar just said, go ahead.
It's all about, nowadays it's all about me.
Me. Correct. So the meaning, the location is no longer external, it's internal. This is the rise of the individual. Locus of meaning. Yeah.
May I add something? Mm-hmm. I mentioned, how people think there. But there's also a very substantial thing that I also forgot to mention.
Yeah.
Is that whether you're a believer or not, whether even you believe in God, there is a fear of God there. A general fear of God. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't even if you're not a believer in God, that you're okay, I'm not a believer in God, but I'm not going to go out of my way to demean God.
Sure.
Which is something I found more in Western culture.
Yeah.
Is that people actually go the extra mile to demean the Lord.
Correct.
I mean, not here, but generally. Mm-hmm. But there it's I don't believe in God, but I still believe that the majority of people believe they're in God. I'm going to be respectful of God. Okay.
Right.
And God plays a major role in the East, in the Eastern culture.
Correct.
Okay.
Interesting.
And I'm going to be okay with that. I'm going to be totally
fine
with
that. That was how I grew up. When I was young, it was like that.
Well, it feels to me like the East... Eastern culture lives more in the pre-modern.
That's probably true.
I was actually thinking pre-modern is most of the world outside of the Western world is still in that headspace. Like, they didn't shift with the crazy that we did.
Yeah.
I think that the United States is God's...
this is your philosophy, yes.
Well, it's God's example. So there are going to be people in different cultures that are going to say, if I had clean water, if I had shoes for my kids, if every third kid didn't die in childbirth, my wife died, if all that, I could have been a believer. I could have accepted you as a righteous God if I'd had all that stuff. And God's going to say, look at these guys.
Oh, yes.
I gave them everything.
Sure.
I gave them water. They got water all day. Who cares, right?
Yeah.
But that's who they were. You know what I mean? Yeah. It doesn't work that way.
No. And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely more that could be said. And I'm just going to say, we just need to know that as we talk to people, that the location of meaning has changed from external to internal. It's all me. It's on the inside. And this is another thing. Remember I said there's Charles Taylor and then there's James K.A. Smith in his book, How Not to Be Secular, where he analyzes Charles Taylor. I get this from him. He says, this is just a good line. Given the culture we live in now, I'm not even going to write it. He said, we're all Thomas now. We're all Thomas now. Doubting Thomas. Because I won't ask you to raise your hands, but we all have doubts about God. We all doubt in some ways. Things that we might say, maybe you did go through a major crisis of faith, but even now as we're talking, you're here in this room and you say, I'm not sure about everything. Why is that the case that you feel that way? What Smith shows, based on what Taylor has written, is just that our belief system is fragile. It's fragile because we know in this room as we live here right now that every worldview, every point that is made, if you watch news, we know that every worldview is contested. Every belief system is contested. Does that make sense? So we know, even as this, and as I just said, that we're here, we're evangelical Protestant Christians. But we know that we live in this culture where a number of people think we're wrong. And just think we're crazy. That affects us, whether we realize it or not. When we talk about discipling our kids, that's why we have to disciple them. Because they need to know that they're going to deal with this. That they're going to be people that are going to challenge them and say, this is absolutely crazy. So that's our context in which we live. That he says, everyone is Thomas now. Do you agree with that? Or what do you think about that? Do you understand what I'm saying? He calls it, we're in a cross-pressured society. Because we're just one view among many. Do you find that affects you or no? You're looking like you're not sure about what he says there. Go ahead.
Me, it makes my faith stronger, but I came to faith when I was young with a child's faith, and it never has seemed to leave me.
Okay.
So the doubting part isn't there, although I do like to talk to Miss Rose.
Okay.
She's my Thomas.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So that's all the number two was, that we're all Thomas now. Does that make sense, or what are your thoughts?
I'm thinking this thread of thinking here that I can kind of see why that might have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these minds that we've talked about and the things they came up with in their day was amazing, but the speed at which it got to everybody else, it took a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody in the whole world can hear about different thoughts or beliefs.
Right. Yeah, that too. Mm-hmm.
And so it's like... You know, people are even think, or even to even get to a place where they doubt instead of just, as Zahir said, in a culture of just kind of generally believing. You know, doubting wasn't even an option until the knowledge got so accessible.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got all these people writing, and then the technology. It's just, I'm thinking that that's probably contributing to why everybody can be Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think that this affected me because even though I grew up as a child like you did in the faith with parents who were faithful going to church, I didn't own the faith and I didn't really, it didn't sink deep into me until I took the time to really go through the philosophy and go through the apologetics and be like, you know, I suppose I God's grace was what enabled me to start that process. But then I had to ask myself, was that just a deep emotional, like, you know, hallucination moment that I had? Or was there something underneath it? And then when I found the next thing underneath it, then I had to ask the question, what's underneath that? You know, it's basically turtles all the way down. Could I get to the point where I believed as far as I could possibly go that it all held up?
Yeah. Just make sure. Okay.
Well, with me being raised in an Episcopal background, it was all about the religious symbolism. You know, it wasn't until after marriage and we found, you know, a little church in a middle school that wasn't based on the sacraments and the rituals and all the, you know.
Just going through the liturgy?
Yeah. Right. I mean, my dad made me a little prayer bench that I had in my bedroom when I was a child. You know, I was so into the ritual of the church and the praying and the, you know, catechism and the communion and the whole bit, you know. And so there's been a drastic change there.
Well, before we finish then, let's just say this. We've come a long way. Hopefully this, just want to see where we're at, and we'll get to right now. I guess what I put there next was that after all this taking place, God, quote-unquote, dies in the mind of the culture. That comes from Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche is the one who said God is dead. Okay, by that, he meant the idea of God has died. So God, prior, so God was basically seen as a device that could explain something. You know, they call it the God of the Gaps theory, right? That if that was the idea with science, that if you couldn't explain it, well, then God must have done it. But a statement that kind of explains where we've come up to this point was made by, this will summarize everything, by an astronomer by the name of Pierre Laplace. I don't know if you know that name, but he was asked, he did his work of astronomy, and he was asked by Napoleon Bonaparte why in his book he had failed to mention God in his astronomy textbook. And he gave the famous answer, "Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis." That's what they say, that sort of summarizes the God has died aspect in that moment, you know, where, because people would believe in God, if they couldn't explain something, they would appeal to God. But now it's like, well, we figured it out. We have the answers. Taylor makes, I think, an interesting observation, Charles Taylor, about how this relates, this kind of scientific mentality. We're going to get it when we get to the problem of evil, but you talked about it, like people, the biggest reason people give today for not believing in God is because all this evil has taken place. Well, what Taylor shows, prior to the modern period, you know, the death of children, the death of spouses, natural disasters and so forth, he said all of that at one point used to lead people to lament, to write a prayer of lament to God. In our period, we use it as an excuse not to believe in God. He said it may be because in this scientific mindset, everything can be explained. It can be explained, but we don't have a quote-unquote perfect answer to the problem of evil. So therefore, again, like I said, if I can't think of an answer of why there would be a God who created all of this and yet allows evil things to take place, if I can't come up with an answer, one must not exist. Right? And Taylor says that's the answer he comes to, is that what's the difference between, because it's not like we're the first generation where people have had horrible things happen to them. Read the book of Job. Read all during the Protestant Reformation. I mean, John Owen, one of the Puritans, he had 11 children. 10 of them died before. Okay, what's that?
I said there was a whole flood
there. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a whole things like that happened. But they never said, I wouldn't believe in God. What Taylor says is, he said he thinks now what's happened is that basically we think we have the answer. That we can't live with that tension of, I don't know the answer, but I'll continue to trust. That doesn't seem to satisfy many people anymore. So, okay. Finally, we're almost done. Postmodernism. So here's the gist. Here's the point of basically where we've come to now. Pre-modern period, truth exists in the Bible. Modernism, science, or truth exists, the scientific method will lead to truth. Postmodernism, you probably know where I'm going. There is no truth. And what's been interesting, this is basically the time in which we live now. Some would say it's not really postmodern, they'll call it the late modern period, whatever. I'm not going to go into that. But now, postmodernism has helped us in some ways. A Christian philosopher whose name I can't remember off the top of my head right now. He teaches at Gordon Conwell, though. The president, actually. Whatever the president of the seminary.
Yeah, Hutton, isn't it?
I don't know his name. But I have his book. And he said, postmodernism, he said, if it's shown us anything, postmodernism has shown us that we don't live by mind alone. Mm-hmm. He calls it that. So a postmodern person would basically say, all of these people are just arrogant. Even atheists. So this is what's interesting. A postmodern person, this is kind of a classic textbook, is to say, okay, yeah, I mean, we believe science can show us something. It can show us some things. But why would I take your word for it? What they're going to say is, ultimately, everything comes down to power. You just want to have power over me. Everything is, there's no truth, so everything's reduced to power. Go ahead.
History is written by the victors.
Yes, you're going to hear that all too. Yeah, history is written by the winners. It's a reaction against this that just say that, these people are just very arrogant. The fact that you think that you can come to truth and know it absolutely is just the height of arrogance. Is what they would basically say. And here's the big thing. If you read postmodern philosophy, and I alluded to it last week, but I'll just say it again. The big thing with postmodernism is that language is incapable of communicating truth.
Is that true?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. I mentioned it last week that Jacques Derrida, the philosopher who says that, writes books to communicate that point. And so everything is just meaningless. We're trapped in language, and language is incapable of conveying truth.
Oh, so if the other one was meaning is outside of us, this one's meaning is inside of us, and there is no meaning.
Correct. Okay. And this is existentialism. There is no meaning, so therefore you have to make meaning. I don't remember the philosopher who wrote it. You can find it online, I'm sure. There's one philosopher who begins his textbook by saying, and no kidding, this is a way to begin a book. He says, the biggest question that we need to ask ourselves every day is, why not kill myself?
Honestly, no, it's honestly.
Why not kill somebody else?
Yeah, sure. Why not kill myself? Because there's no meaning to life. But again, like I said before, I think one of the questions you have to ask yourself is my worldview livable? Right? What I find interesting, let me just check the time one more time, is what I find interesting is that people would say there's no meaning to life. But when you look at these philosophers, you find that a lot of them are married and have children.
How do you suppose that makes their kids feel?
That's a good question. I really don't know. So one way you can see this, and I'm 3 more minutes, and just because I want us to see this, and then we'll be done. That postmodernism, if you read on it, one way they try to explain how the meaninglessness expresses itself is in art. So they're going to look at architecture and to see that there's no truth, so there's no aesthetic standards. So, for example, I'm not making this up. Gene Veith writes about this in his book on postmodernism. He says, if you walk into art museums that are influenced by postmodernism, when you look at their pictures, sometimes what you'll find is the art is pictures of urinals. Pictures of, I'm not kidding, I'm sorry, we already ate. A picture, an art form would be a picture of a toilet bowl with feces inside of it. That's art. And then the worst, and I'm not even kidding you here, is child pornography. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but the porn industry justifies itself, its position, by saying that it is a form of art. If you want to see this in music, I forget the individual. Some of you may know this, but I'm not making it up. I went on YouTube just to check and verify that it's there. There's a, I don't even want to call him a piano player. But what this I can't call him an artist, but they call him an artist. So his music performance, I'm not kidding you, is if you're in a, there's a stage and there's a piano there, and what the guy does is he comes down, he sits on the chair, he doesn't play the piano, he just sits there in dead silence and doesn't move.
Unless.
Yeah, and then he sits there for about a minute, and he stands up and walks out, and there's a standing ovation.
I can do that.
Yeah, me too. but it's communicating the meaninglessness of art.
Right.
Yeah, but that's art. We'll say that's art. In architecture, I haven't seen this, but I'm going by... Ravi Zacharias has talked about this as well, that in these places, if you go in certain buildings, they have stairs that lead to nowhere. Yeah. And the classic, you're going to be able to answer this, but the classic TV show, you may know this. What's the TV show that says... There it is, right? What's the show about? Nothing. Right? Seinfeld, right? Seinfeld is seen as sort of the classic postmodern show. That what's the show about? Nothing. It doesn't have a meaning. Do you remember that episode where he talks about that? I wake up one day, talking to George. I wake up, I go to the church. That's an episode. It's right there. That there's nothing. There's no meaning. So, there's more that can be said. Any thoughts? I hope it just helps us see where we're at. And we're going to talk about next week, okay, what's the Christian worldview then? Right. What's the Christian response to this?
The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things on
this. Yeah, I was going to give you, what does it say? Tenets, the basic tenets of postmodernism?
Yeah.
Do you care? Do you want those? I mean, we can review. Yeah, I'm not going to give them to you. Yeah,
there's no need to. There you go.
Yeah. You know what? This is... I was at a Ligonier conference one time. It was about postmodernism. And they were trying to tell people over and over again to not use flash photography with Dr. Sproul. Don't save seats when people would save their seats and leave. And, of course, everybody kept doing all that. And so the communicator, the guy who was leading it, said, and just so you're aware, this conference is on postmodernism, but when we gave you those instructions, there was nothing postmodern about that. We really want you to listen to the directions when we're that we're giving to you. Forever, 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 forever.